What's up, everybody, and welcome back to Podcast Unscripted. Probably going to rebrand this yet again to frame it in the sense of a journey. And that is the journey from now through the shitstorm. Pardon my language. You can hear a lot of that. So it's not really family friendly podcast, should any more than two people end up listening to it. But this is going to be about the journey of A, my learning about what we're dealing with, what we're really dealing with, and B, the journey to kind of catalog the progress and the march towards this dystopian system being put in place as it happens in real time for as long as we can before, being deplatformed. So first, right off the bat, I want to encourage people, if anybody's listening, to check out my website, which is a work in progress. It's blockchoppers.com, BLOCKCHOPPERS.com. And on there is a host of different things, short stories, monologues, most importantly, news, and a little bit about what the site is about. It also includes a link to this podcast, which hopefully will grow. And there's a lot of things I want to do with the website that I'm learning how to do and will hopefully be included soon, like a digital trading post. So, like, local community stuff, newsletters, and a whole lot more. But the website is really designed at looking above the crisis situations we see unfolding on the ground, above the pandemic medical emergency, above the elected representatives and officials, and taking a look at, as Alison McDowell would say, who we're going to talk about, really interrogating the system. And when I say the system, I don't mean the system in terms of the things you hear on the news. I don't mean the system in terms of those who are social justice warriors. Bless their hearts, some of them really have good hearts and just don't understand that the term itself, social justice, is a frightening term in and of itself. We're going to take a look at all of those and examine along this journey how they are, but the symptoms of the disease. And the disease is this, for lack of a better word, this predator energy. Really, it is this agenda. And what's the agenda? The agenda is really quite simple, although there's nothing simple about it. Great line from the movie The Giver. It's really very simple, although there's nothing simple about it. There's been many changes in the course of human history, and as far as we're aware, based on the information we're given as history. And those changes, when they happened, were so massive that new vocabulary was created to talk about them, to discuss them, to describe that, just incorporate them into our vernacular and our everyday world. So when you had the Industrial Revolution, just think about all the new vocabulary that sprang up around that. The latest Industrial Revolution. And now we're going to have the Fourth Industrial Revolution. So what's that really about? Well, the Fourth Industrial Revolution is what we're going to be exploring. But if I had to encapsulate it in just a moment or two, I would say it is, again, simply put, but there's nothing simple about it at all. It's hard for people to wrap their mind around. It's the movement from carbon-based life to silicon-based life. So back to what I was saying just a second ago, with each major shift, the people living at the time before the shift happened, before the change happened, didn't have the vocabulary to describe it, nor the ability to conceptualize it, because you didn't have a framework. You didn't know the certain things were even possible. And so you had a difficult time imagining it, and you weren't given the information to begin the process of imagining it. Through all my research and through all of that stuff, I can certainly imagine it, write stories about it, conceptualize it, but I struggle intensely with the vocabulary. I can use the vocabulary that the global leadership that these people are using. But that vocabulary hasn't yet been given to the population. And therefore, it's still foreign to me and to them. And so it doesn't make it palatable. It doesn't make it real. It's still hard to convey. And it's also, there's so many moving parts. So what I'm going to try to do is just, as best as I can, focus on some of the stuff that matters the most and some of the key players. So understand first and foremost that this is a global thing. It's not unique to the United States. It's not unique to Russia. It's not unique to Belgium. It's not unique to Estonia. I suppose it is somewhat unique to Estonia because of the 10 digital nations, but this movement is a global thing. They need everybody around the world in every country to be on board to make it happen. So every government needs to get in line. So the question is, who's behind the scenes making them do that? Because it's happening. And they have all kinds of every imaginable tool at their disposal to make it happen. So over the course of several podcasts, we'll begin to pick apart pieces of that, from what the smart cities are going to be like. And I'm going to tell you that they're going to be like reservations. You know, Alison McDowell talks about the dispossession template a lot. What we're going to be dealing with, for all the neatness and that comes with the tech of a smart city resonating with your body and all of that, essentially what you're going to have is a situation where you are regulated and you have no freedom whatsoever. So let's see first if I can find this clip on decentralized autonomous organizations. So I want to play this real quick for you. And if the quality is not fantastic, I apologize in advance. So let me go ahead and share the screen. No, close that bad boy. Open this up. Now, let's see, I should be able to. Okay, share. So you can see there, this is from a longer presentation. It's actually a decent presentation. And they're explaining the basics of decentralized autonomous organizations. So let's go ahead and play this clip. Basically, real quick, a DAO, and I have a blog post on this describing more what it is, and you can certainly watch more of this clip. But what it is it's advocating an organization. You can create one yourself, but ultimately I think corporations are going to be run like this, where human beings kind of sit at the periphery, but artificial intelligence runs the organization on the blockchain and smart contracts, and develops algorithms that determine participants' level of power and decision-making authority. But let's just real quick listen to what this Stanford student has to say here.
Where people can buy at a certain price and sell at a lower price. And kind of as people buy more shares into a DAO or a network, a DAO can increase its treasury and begin having funds that way. There are also mechanisms such as liquidity mining or airdrops, which were kind of popularized this past year in the DeFi space by Uni and Oneinch and several other projects, in which if users of a certain project are now, if they wake up one day and they're like, oh, well, now I have a lot of this Uni token or Oneinch token, sort of as a reward for being part of this network. DAOs can have very precise decision making. So based on, say, someone's reputation or token weighting. So if anyone is familiar, say, with like the Bridgewater mechanism of decisions are allocated based on reputation or emotions.
Say no more for now. I'm going to continue watching, but I'm going to stop recording this. Decisions are based on someone's reputation and or emotions. So who gets to define what the acceptable reputation is? What does that mean? What are the metrics? We'll see if he gets into that in here, but I doubt it. And then the emotions part. What does he want? everyone to stop being human. That's right. That's exactly what they want.
All right. So stop share. So I'll leave a cliffhanger as to whether or not they get into that more and more throughout the presentation. It's really a cursory look at what a DAO is. And they do, to their credit, they put on a good presentation. And maybe at the end of the day, young college students like that really think they're doing a good thing for the world. But what critical thinking questions are we asking? What ethics questions are we asking? I mean, essentially what you're talking about here is allowing this algorithm to decide whether or not you're worthy of having tokens, participating in their little organization. What happens when that extends outward? Because it will metastasize. I mean, it's already happening. They're popping up everywhere. And their ultimate goal is to have e-governments run this way. That's what the 10 digital nations are about. So there will be this layer of AI. I look at it as a sentient algorithm, maybe, that is a buffer between you and the talking heads that are technically your, you know, MPs or your Congress people here in the States and senators. You will lose access more and more to real people, and decision-making authority will be, quote, decentralized and put in the hands of this on the blockchain of AI. So many questions to be answered, and they do a terrible job at being transparent. So one of the things I said in my blog post is that what troubles me the most is that as we move toward really being trapped in these smart cities, nobody's really talking about dual use. So however cool the tech may be, no one's talking about the other possibilities. Allison breaks down in a long presentation. Maybe I'll include the clip in the next podcast that I do, where she talks about, I think it's the Casitas pods, the smart pods. If it's not those, it's one of them. There's several different projects, but you know, pretend you have your QR code. Your QR code is your medical pass, and on it, it's also your social score, as this young man just talked about, kind of like they have in China. Well, we're all set up and ready for it to go here, believe me. And it's all but in effect already. It's just not full throttle. We'll notice when it gets there. But imagine you have this QR code, and you know, I mean, you don't really think about it. It's like, you know, you walk, you go into your house, you go out, you go into the city, you bounce around, it resonates with things, you scan it to get in here, you scan it to see a menu, you scan it to allow you to prove that you're vaccinated, you scan it to pay for your drink at Starbucks, you scan it for everything. But then, so you've done something you shouldn't have done. Maybe you weren't social enough, maybe you littered, maybe I don't know, maybe a million different things. And all of a sudden, it stops working when you try to get out of your three-story, you know, your little pod on the third floor. You know, imagine that, you know, when I several years ago, I was, I went on a little business trip for leadership training. It was probably the fanciest hotel I ever stayed in, at the Charles K. or F. Knight Conference Center. I could be totally off, but it was at Washington University in Philadelphia, St. Louis. And it was beautiful, beautiful place, beautiful campus, beautiful conference center. But place was like, you close the door and it's like for paying customers, it's like $400 a night. And that may not sound like a lot to some, but it's more money than, I mean, I didn't have to pay, but it's more money than I've ever imagined spending on a freaking hotel room, period. And it was nice, but I mean, $400. I mean, for that, I feel like I should have gotten a lot more. But anyway, you needed a special fob or whatever, like a card, to get to that, to the floor where our rooms were. You needed, you know, you would get to floor three and then you'd need it to scan it. So what if everything is lighting up green and then the algorithm's like, nope, once he gets back into his pod, we'll let them know that, you know, just like YouTube sends you an email or whatever, that due to community guidelines, blah, blah, blah. And you go to scan your thing to get out and you can't. Or you can, but you can't get on the elevator and you can't get out of the stair. You're stuck there. Or you can leave the facility, but you're only allowed to go to get food at this one particular store. And you have to use your programmable money to do it. You know, so there's a lot. I mean, we'll get it as we go down this journey. We'll talk more about the different kind of nightmare situations. But I wanted to, if I can, look at this clip from Judith Roden. Now, Judith Roden is, this is from several years ago. She used to work at the Rockefeller Foundation. I was just looking at her profile on LinkedIn. Let's go ahead and look her up. She recently came out with yet another book on resilience, and that is that's the clip that I actually wanted to show, because it came out, she's still at the Rockefeller Fund, no, it came out relatively recent, or maybe it wasn't recent, but they just interviewed her on it. This was an interview, I think, on ABC, and it was in June, I believe, of last year. So it was in 2020. Let's see if we can find it. Oops. Because I think it's actually really good. Well, you know, just for the heck of it, I would love to watch Judith Roden on resilient cities. You know what? Let's go ahead and let's watch just a bit of that. Because, well, why not? Where'd it go? Sorry, this is what happens when things are live. Well, they're not live, but you know what I'm trying to say. Or you don't, either way. Where in the world is it? There we go. Sharing. We're gonna have to or are we just jumping right in?
Hi, my name is Ava Daniel, and I'm here at the BSR Conference 2015, where we're discussing the theme of resilient business, resilient world. And I'm here with Judith Roden, the president of the Rockefeller Foundation. Welcome, Judith.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Thank you for coming. So, as I said, we're talking about the theme of resilience, which is a very that you're focused on at the Rockefeller Foundation. My first question is, how do you focus on resilience at Rockefeller?
Well, we view resilience of communities, cities, nations, and businesses as all part of our portfolio, because we live in a world in which crisis is the new normal. And so being able to prepare for...
Keep in mind, this is a psychiatrist, if I'm not mistaken. So... In the interview I was looking for, the reason I was looking for it specifically was because it struck me just how much she's talking like, you know, fear mongering. I mean, she's essentially telling people to panic. She's doing nothing to really, nothing you would think of as from an actual psychiatrist, if that's what she is. She's President Rockefeller Foundation. She's a philanthropist, it says, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe she's not a doctor. I could have sworn that she was. Academic career, became associate professor, popular lecturer. Okay, so yeah, she's including the dean of graduate school, arts, science, and department chair of psychology. So let's see. She encouraged blah, blah, blah. The establishment of Wharton School Alliances for Small Businesses sounds really, really great. Now she works for the Rockefeller Foundation, but let's see. So she has her MA and PhD. So what does she ever? All right, I don't feel like looking it all up. The bottom line is that she is in the field of psychology, I believe. And the idea Sorry for the pause. Okay, a research psychologist by training. So I guess I shouldn't expect her to, you know, show that caring touch that a normal psychologist would, because she's a research psychologist. So she's cold, calculating, and terrible. Anyway, back to it.
Crises and shocks, but also if they do occur, to rebound more effectively, and then to transform and grow in the face of that kind of shock. Often there's the tendency to want to become normal again, but some of the vulnerabilities that were problematic initially need to be changed, and so we see resilience as an opportunity for transformation.
Okay, so instead of seeing resilience for what it actually means, which is the ability to sustain and bounce back after, you know, really traumatic or serious events that pose a challenge, a hurdle, or set you back, or, you know, put you back to square one entirely, knock you on your butt, knock you on your ass. She's describing it as being prepared for transformation. So, you know, just redefine words however you want to, right?
And there are a lot of different dimensions to resilience, and one of them is leadership. And as a leader of the Water College Foundation, what's the definition for you?
Sorry about that. I know I'm getting annoying. Just the fact that they used leadership and Rockefeller Foundation in the same sentence was a little, I retched a little bit. I don't know if you noticed, but I threw up in my mouth just a little bit. It didn't come up all the way, so that's good. Anyway, hit it.
Resilience, as I said, is the capacity to plan and
she's just repeating shit,
effectively, creatively, and innovatively, and certainly those are capacities that are qualities of leadership. But resilient leadership also includes increased awareness and understanding that redundancy in business is not a bad word, but actually adds to flexibility. Resilient leadership is an integrated leadership. It's consultative and knows what all the parts are doing. It is nimble and more adaptive. And so we really do see a different kind of leadership. We have a very significant initiative, as I think you know, called 100 Resilient Cities. So we are teaching mayors how to be more resilient.
Okay, teaching mayors how to be more resilient. I think it was a day or two before they officially declared the pandemic, where all or many of the mayors from around the country were together and basically being told how they were going to handle this thing. So she's talking about coaching mayors. What she really means is we're giving them marching orders, just like governors, just like presidents.
Of our cities gets a chief resilience officer, which we hope businesses will start to model as well, because those elements of leadership are really critical for the 21st century.
That's great. Thank you for all the work that you're doing, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, shit, that was on video. And thank you so much. Oh, my God. Yeah, you're what a pioneer. Anyway, so yeah, it's Judith Rodin, and I should probably stop obsessing, but I really, really did want to find that ABC clip. Now I'm obsessing over it because it just said so much. And it's so recent that, I mean, if I can't find it here, then I'll just come back to it another time. I really feel like I should be able to find it here. Judith Rodin. Well, oh well. Let's try one more thing. Anybody who's tuned in is probably tuning out, but it was ABC, CBS. I really wanted to show this because it was just, it was perfect. It highlighted just so much of just her entire approach to, and how she, this is it right here, and how she answered these questions. All right, so let's go ahead and take a look. And then discuss it a little bit, or, you know, just move right on. We'll figure it out. So let's go ahead and get the screen share going. Bada bing. And share. Let's take a look.
Could be mass disruptions becoming unfortunately more frequent than ever right now. Our country facing civil conflict and new strains of disease, so it seems.
Remember, this is in June of last year.
These days for surviving the turbulence of the 21st century, or at least 2020. Here to talk about resilience with us is psychologist and author of The Resilience Dividend, Being Strong in a World Where Things Go Wrong, Dr. Judith Rodin. Thanks so much for being with us. And wow, I don't think we've ever needed your words of wisdom more than ever before. You've said crisis is the...
Yes, I know. This gets annoying, but I just have to chime in, and it's not going to be the last time. Never needed your words of wisdom more than we do now. If I just want you to remember that statement, tack it to your invisible wall or whatever, and let's come back to that at the end of the 4 minutes and 59 seconds and still see if you think, ask yourself, if you think that you need to hear this woman's words of wisdom. If they mattered, if they really made you feel good, gave you tools to be strong.
New normal, that's a very overwhelming thing to think about. How do we deal with that?
Well, thanks so much, Amy and Jen, for having me. Think about it this way. I would say not a month has gone by in this century without something frightening erupting, whether it's floods or hurricanes.
All right, I know it's getting annoying, but that's a big statement. It's also called everyday life. Keep in mind, when this interview was done, it was sometime in May, June, or July of 2020. And she's talking about every month so far in this century. So she's, instead of, you know, putting things into perspective as a responsible psychologist and helping you frame it, you know, in a reasonable sense, she's basically doubling down on the panic porn and saying, look, not only have we had these several crises that you've known about, every single month so far in this century has just been filled with crisis situations. And it's terrible. It's not going away, right? So here's what we need to do. She's going to tell us.
Wildfires, tornadoes, as well as economic
shit
shocks,
your pants.
And now pandemics, social unrest, and violence.
Oh my goodness gracious. Great balls of fire.
And they are creating crisis.
Yes.
And Judy.
Yes, greater frequency because Jude, oh, they're on the Judy, instead of Dr. Rodin. You know, Judy, after this, we're going to have a glass of wine. Like she has all of human history cataloged, you know. I'm going to try to keep my mouth shut.
I've used your book as a Bible
I'm
so
gonna
often throughout this pandemic, but you've said...
I'm sorry, I have to stop right there real quick. Hold on. Let me take my pulse. Can't believe she just said that, my Bible. Okay, well, it's elevated about 75, but considering the fact that she just referred to Judith Rodin's book on how to basically profit off of the misery of poor children in foreign countries and here at home, and then referred to it as a Bible, that's just remarkable. Also, I will bet $100, and I'm serious about that, a crisp $100 bill, which to me is a lot, that this chick, that's right, I said it. Yo, you misogynist. This chick never, ever, ever read the book. Guaranteed. 100% guaranteed.
Resilience isn't something you're born with, but it's a skill you learn. What do you mean by that?
Tell us what you mean. You're full of shit.
Luckily, Jen, resilience isn't a personality variable. Often when it's talked about, it sounds like it's something you either have or you don't have. From birth. It's a skill. You can learn it, and therefore you have to practice it. And if you do, if you build resilience, skills that it enables you to rebound more effectively when crisis hits.
Okay, let me stop right there. Now, if she was talking like this and then building on this by empowering people, that would be one thing. But of course, unless I missed something, for which I will apologize deeply, this is my second time watching this, I hope that I missed something and I'm completely wrong, but let us continue. Because empowerment, that's not her style.
Interestingly, the data have shown that it even develops the capacity to grow and transform more effectively as a result. So we should be building these capacities for ourselves, for our families, our communities,
the communities,
institutions we care about, because they enable us to handle a crisis better. And they also work in the good times.
There's a lot of growing to do here. I know
You
said that there's a difference between slow burning stresses versus a crisis. Yes. So how do you prepare for those two differently?
Tell us.
They start very differently. So a crisis appears suddenly. It needs a rapid set of responses in the moment. Slow burning stresses build slowly, like drought or air pollution or inequality.
Sorry, I need to stop again. I've read this book and I just want to point out to people that no need to spend money on it, at least not the full price. Go to Half Price Books. It's shocking to me that she's a powerful mover and shaker. Obviously, she's very intelligent, but I would say she's probably more, and I'm being dead serious here, she's probably more of a sociopath or a psychopath than anything else, because when you read the book, you kind of get the sense that a 12-year-old, maybe a 12-year-old in the gifted and talented classes, but a 12-year-old nonetheless could come to the same conclusions about the basic stuff, she says. Anyway.
Build over a long period of time, and suddenly a set of events triggers them. Because they've been so long.
They've just been bottled up.
You actually prepare for them in the same way.
Yeah.
And Judy, as the nation is coming out of lockdown and dealing with really, in effect, two crises simultaneously,
dueling crises,
a medical and a societal one, what tips would you give for building personal resilience as individuals?
I just want to say I've got butterflies in my stomach because I'm pretty sure this is where it gets really good.
Well, there are four primary characteristics. Awareness is the first. And so
awareness. Awareness of strengths, weaknesses, and circumstances, capacity for continuous monitoring and mindfulness. So I'm going to translate a little bit. Awareness of where you're good, awareness of where you suck, awareness of how hopeless your circumstances are. And your capacity for continuing to consume all the crap they put out on TV and on the radio. Next.
An answer. You have to watch, monitor the environment.
And be obsessed.
You have to track the data.
These people wouldn't know data if it was really, I don't know. Let me put it this way. They don't want to know data. The interviewer here, this anchor, I'm sure she's perfectly nice, but if you smeared shit all over her lips, she wouldn't be able to smell it. Now, Dr. Judith Rodin should know all about data. She just doesn't use it. She calls it data and then expects you to assume it's data, like real data, but it's not. And she knows that most people aren't going to look any further than this. They're going to think that this is just, they're going to look at these words and extol them as if they're gospel.
Have to become aware because some places are safer than others.
Yes.
The impact.
Be aware of what's safe all the time. Like if there's a neighborhood, believe me, soon they're going to have little maps of neighborhoods where you have the concentration of vaccinated people and not be aware. Be very aware. Be very scared all the time. That way you can bounce back.
So those are very important things to be aware of. Mm-hmm. Diversity is the second. You need to construct a set of options to get what you need or where you need to go. You need to think it through and develop it in advance. That's why experts do scenario planning. So you're not forced in.
So in theory, I agree with her on self-preparation. Where I don't agree is that she has something very different in mind. All right, you read her book, you read her material, and you realize that she has something very different in mind. But let's hear what she has to say.
Into one place or to using one solution at the time. The third is adaptability. You have to remain alert as you come out of this, be nimble and flexible, be willing and be able to change course quickly when things go.
So notice, I mean, that statement right there is loaded with fear, right? Be ready to adjust to forced relocation. Be ready to adjust to all kinds of restrictions. Be ready to adjust to a completely new societal structure. Be ready to adjust to whatever it is we have to do to be resilient together, to bounce back for this thing, from this thing. Humans are sheeple anyway. I mean, that's what we follow. We don't, you know, we want to take the path of least resistance, and that's understandable. People don't want to get hurt. They just want to live a peaceful life, which is what I want to do too. And so they'll go along with this. But what she's essentially saying, and it's easy to see this more clearly after you read her stuff, and she's written extensively and talked extensively. But what she's essentially saying here is, and you know, if you've read her stuff, is, you know, when stuff changes, we're going to change it real quick. Or we may have a slow burn. Either way, be ready to adapt. And that's what makes you resilient. And a failure to do so, to question things, makes you something else.
The longer where circumstances make you concerned. And the fourth may surprise people, but we call it safe failure. You can't control everything, but you actually can build and use the capacity to fail safely rather than catastrophically by preparing in advance. And so you need to quickly separate what's creating the problem from other parts of the situation, and that you can do. So as we come out of lockdown, this is going to influence not only our own personal safety, but how and if the virus continues to spread.
Thank you so much for your time and for your words, Dr. Roden. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Hi, everyone. George Stephanopoulos here. Thanks for checking.
Okay. Sorry about that. It must have been traumatic for some people to have to hear George Stephanopoulos's voice, even for a moment. I know it's really hard. So Judith Roden, no good. And we can dive into more about her, what impact investing is. It sounds really boring and all that. It's actually incredibly important. Basically, she's one of the individuals guiding us into essentially a reservation system. These smart cities are going to be places where we cannot move around, places where we have no freedom, whatever. Now, they're going to be really neat. There's going to be a lot of neat things about them. There's no doubt about it. A lot of the technology, the convenience, but they're going to be incredibly restrictive. You're not going to be able to have your own vehicle. You may have an electric car, but mostly there will be autonomous vehicles. But, you know, you're going to be beholden to those, and they're going to be based Stanford boy said there about the DAOs and decision-making ability. Well, the algorithm decides that based on metrics and based on how you've behaved and all kinds of other things. Well, do you not see the slippery slope that's going to grow within the DAOs? That's for one thing. That's going to grow. And also, I mean, it's going to permeate and is meant to permeate every area of life, right? Society in general will be governed, if we don't stop, by a series of blockchains. And what I envision, although I don't know, we'll learn more together as we go on this journey, to be kind of a master blockchain. So there will be several blockchains, the Ethereum blockchain. I think a lot of it is going to come down to smart contracts. And that's a discussion for a whole nother time. And I would love to talk to people who are in the legal field, legal sphere, and can speak to more about what that means. But it's like, this information supposedly, you know, is safe and can't be hacked, but that's not true. It can. Really, what we're talking about is a world where, like right now, I can get in my car, and provided I have the funds, I can drive from here in Austin, Texas to Florida to see my parents. My parents are elderly, hate using that term. Sure, they hate hearing it, but it's true. Y'all are fucking old. But I love them dearly. They're old as dirt, but good as gold. And but I can get out there just to, or if there's an emergency, I can get in my car and get out there. Along the way, if I want to stop and see a million different parks and wildlife area, I can do that. That is not going to be the case for very long, for reasons that we'll get into another time. But they are looking at, she's talking about adjusting to rapidly changing circumstances and being resilient. And the reason she's talking about that is because the changes that are coming are going to be so massive that there are no words to describe it yet. Like I said, the vocabulary has not been invented. I mean, it sort of has, but not really, not in the amongst the people. We'll make it up as we start living it. And we certainly don't have the framework to conceptualize it. If you were a Native American, I don't know too much about the various tribes, I'll admit, but let's just say you were Native American and you were living somewhere in New England, and you hadn't encountered people with firearms yet. And in fact, you hadn't even ever seen a ship yet. And these new people arrive on this big ship, this big thing from across the ocean, wherever, you don't know where. And they're carrying these tools that can kill game to eat, or can kill in battle, and you don't know what their plans are, and you can't even begin to wrap your mind around it. You may know what it is to fight. You may know what it is to protect your tribe. You may know all kinds of different things, but you cannot wrap your mind around the scope and scale of how everything's about to change. And that's just throughout human history. That's kind of a common thread. There probably were several tribes and several leaders that were incredibly prescient and understood, whether it was intuitively or whatever, the nature of what was about to happen, at least to a degree. But most probably didn't until it did, right? The changes in the political and geopolitical landscape in Europe after the First World War and the Second World War brought changes that we couldn't even imagine and didn't have the framework in our mind, the template to even imagine that world, nor the vocabulary to describe it. You know, there's a great clip. Let's see if we can find it here. There's a great clip on YouTube, and it's called The Early 1900s. And I think it's fantastic. Here it is, because it talks about just that, talks about the vocabulary. So let's see real quick if we can get that going.
So you took,
of course, all these stinking commercial advertisements here. Share and skip and start over. Okay, so here we go. We'll just watch the first 3 minutes or so.
In the fall of 1899, Sigmund Freud was preparing the publication of his masterpiece, The Interpretation of Dreams. Though the book would come out in November of that year, Dr. Freud requested that the title page be dated with the year 1900, for the book would belong, he said, to the new century. The new century seemed at first much like the old.
Same in 2000.
Queen Victoria still sat on the British throne, a throne she had held for 62 years. Gas lamps lit the thoroughfares of major cities, and the laws of Sir Isaac Newton still defined the universe. In the United States, Butch Cassidy, the Sundance Kid, and the rest of the Wild Bunch were robbing banks and trains in Colorado and Wyoming, while Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West Show gave command performances all over the world. In the summer of 1900, thousands of prospectors who had failed to strike it rich in California, Nevada, and Colorado raced to the Yukon in the latest gold rush. 35 years after the end of the Civil War, the letters GAR for Grand Army of the Republic still carry great weight in American politics. President McKinley was a Civil War veteran, as were Presidents Harrison, Arthur, Garfield, Hayes, and Grant before. The English language was much smaller in 1900. People had never heard of radios, movies, or crossword puzzles. There were no tractors, trucks, or tanks, no amplifiers, modulators, no electronics of any kind. There was no such thing as camouflage, no propaganda, no cafeterias or vaccinations. There were no chauffeurs, aviators, realtors, or hijackers. There was no income tax, no primaries, no referendums or recall votes, no city managers, no Rotary or Kiwanis. People were neither Bolshevists, modernists, fascists, nor feminists. They didn't listen to jazz or gospel or bluegrass. They had never seen a neon light. They weren't schizophrenic or psychotic. They didn't have neuroses or complexes. They didn't wear polyester or synthetics of any kind, nor sunglasses, lipstick, or bras. No one used pesticides or fluoride. Like no other time before it, the history of the 20th century can be measured out in the sheer volume of words we had to invent to describe it.
So there you go. And that is what we're on the precipice of right now. What we're going to be left with after this transition, hopefully it doesn't happen, or doesn't happen fully, is going to be, I mean, we don't, and that's what makes it so difficult to warn people about. This is different than those changes. Of course, every generation, so to speak, thinks that whatever shift is coming their way is different than what people have experienced in the past. But this really is different because it involves technology that is taking us to an entirely different place, it aims to take us outside of ourselves, into the ether, so to speak. That is, you know, you look up Japan's moonshot project, and what's one of their goals? To have us out of our, using our mind, not our body, by the year 2050. So, like, you know, basically augmented reality, and we live our lives through these avatars. Kind of hard to describe, but we'll describe it more and more as we kind of go through the podcast in just little bits and pieces. Definitely every Friday, but we may have to catch up a little bit and do a little bit here and there. I think one of the bigger issues too, well, there's a lot of big issues, but it's difficult to get people to divest from the idea that this, these cryptocurrencies, this blockchain, smart, all of it, you know, isn't, it's pitched, especially in the libertarian corners, it's pitched as a way to get government off your back. It's pitched as a truly democratic. It's pitched as respecting the sovereignty of the individual. The unbelievable thing, like, just leaves me gobsmacked each time, is that it's the exact opposite of each of those things. It's a complete attack on your self-sovereignty. All right. It strips you of that in totality, in every way, strips you of that. It is not democratic. It's not. I don't care what they tell you, they've coded it. I don't. At the end of the day, artificial intelligence is in charge. Algorithms are in charge. And we'll talk more and more about that. But with all their fancy tech talk and all their flowery language, there's the question that they haven't been able to answer. There's several, but one of them, what's going to be the collateral, the commodity backing that's tied to this and giving it value? Well, I would say there'd be a few things, and I'll start in order of importance. People. When I say people, I mean data. So you and your data. Two, water. Three, food. You might could lump them together. Four, energy. And then there's probably some more after that. But data. Data in every sense. And we tend to break data down into much bigger chunks and think that that's what they're giving them. So for example, I have an app on my phone. I don't like it, but it saves me money on car insurance for State Farm. It tracks everywhere I go. Everywhere I go. And for now, I'm using it. I intend to get rid of it, but I figure they already know so much about me for 6 months. What difference does this make? They're going to sell it. They're going to sell it. People already know, whatever. But the data that I'm talking about, that smart city that they're wanting and needing in order to kind of feed the singularity and teach AI how to be human, the data is going to be everything. It's going to be our facial expressions. It's going to be our emotional reactions. It's going to be our personalities. It's going to be everything that you can think of, even the things that you don't think of, because they're so reflexive and human that you just do them. They just happen. And that's all cataloged as well. It will be on the blockchain as a permanent record and will also be used to feed into the everything, the hive mind, that is getting smarter and smarter off of every little thing you think, say, and do. So it's incredibly frightening. It's incredibly all-encompassing, and we're well upon our way. So for today, I'll close out by saying that, yes, the vaccine issue is incredibly important and frightening. It shouldn't surprise anybody that they are now coming out and saying that, you know, they're going to need to roll back some restrictions, that this Delta variant is, you know, taking over, that it's super duper scary, it's the boogeyman. If it wasn't that, then they would say it was an economic issue, or it was a foreign threat or a domestic threat, or they will just roll out a package if they feel like they're getting too much resistance. It's coming whether we like it or not, and so we need to keep the momentum going in order to try to stop the advancement of it, because at the end of the day, what they're after is children. I won't be around that much longer. I know that the system isn't interested in most people, my age and older anyway, but at 39, they might be somewhat interested in me, but the system knows as much as they should know. They know that I'm checking out of this hotel soon, that my time is very limited. So I highly doubt, aside from wiping my YouTube channel clean every now and again, just for funsies, that they really give a shit about me. But they sure shoot give a damn about my niece and nephews and every kid, because that's who they're after. You know, you watch Michael Crow. I don't know if I'll look for the clip another time so I don't have an awkward pause here. Or you can check out my YouTube channel. There's, you know, Alison McDowell's clips are broken down into into like 5 minutes, she gives a 3.5 hour lecture, which really just will tell you everything you need to know. And it's got PowerPoints attached to it, her slideshows, not everything you need to know, but it gives you a hell of an introduction. But anyway, in there, I broke them down into five. I tried to do my best with her permission to repost with chapters and break them down. And there's a couple of clips, and one is of Michael Crow from Arizona State University. And he's giving a speech to students on gamification. But the freaky part is that he states that kids today and kids born recently in the last decade, or especially now going forward, are not from the same species. They're not from the same species. They're human.net, right? They're H+. They're centaurs, which is freaky that they call it that. We can get into another time. I'll include Allison's PowerPoint. You can look into it yourself. Allison's an insanely talented researcher. I don't know how she does it. I think I'm really good, but her ability to synthesize information is impressive, to put it mildly. And boy, is she thorough, and a treasure trove of information. I mean, they tell you what they're doing. So I may have lost my train of thought a little bit there. That's it for now. I will be doing additional episodes to kind of catch back up, and follow me on the journey as we kind of head toward the goalposts. And let's just experience it together. We'll interrogate the system together as best as we can as regular people. We will make observations about the progression or the W's or L's that we're having, the wins and losses together as we go forward. And we'll just kind of experience it together, right? What else can we do? So spread the word. If you know people who are interested, this will get more interesting as we go forward. I'm ready to go on this journey, and I hope you come along with me. Until next time, Zaina, aka just regular old Sean, signing off, and I will see y'all next time. Have a safe night.